So this morning then, we're going to have first of these short talks, four short talks about the lines written in praise of Tara by Nagarjuna. So I'll just read the verses. The single face of the chief lady is the understanding of all events as a single knowledge. The green colour of her body is power in all faculties. Her two hands are the two truths. Her right hand, the conventional truth. Her left hand, ultimate truth. Her wearing of all ornaments is the completion of the stocks of merit and knowledge. Her right hand in the gift-bestowing gesture is the contemplation of the perfection of charity. Her left hand in the protection gesture is the guarding of all beings from fear. Her right leg stretched out is the abandonment of all defects of Mara. Her left leg drawn back is the understanding of all qualities. Her holding of the lotus blossom is the bringing of joy to all beings. Her being 16 years of age is the ability to accomplish the aims of all beings. Her throne of the orb of the moon is the possession of the perfection of wisdom. Her throne of a vari-coloured lotus is the possession of the essence of compassion. So it's a description of the figure of Green Tara, and then linking those various aspects of the figure up to various qualities that she represents. And I've always found it's a fairly easy one to memorise, and I've always found it really beneficial while I do the Green Tara practice. So it partly helps with that. But it's just an easy, simple way of adding in reflections into a meditation. So that's all I'm going to suggest over these four little talks. I'm just going to offer you suggestions of ways of connecting with particular figure that represents compassion. Not, of course, the only bodhisattva that represents compassion, but as it happens, the one we have a very beautiful rupa of here, and the one that Tarloka is dedicated to. I dare say, although the figures of the other compassion-related bodhisattvas are very different, the qualities that Nagarjuna refers to here, you'd find in all those figures, perhaps represented in different ways. So, the lines written in praise of Tara, we're just going to look at the first two. Starting with the first one. The single face of the chief lady is the understanding of all events as a single knowledge. The single face of the chief lady is the understanding of all events as a single knowledge. So this single knowledge then, all events understood as a single knowledge. This being that becomes. From the arising of this, that arises. This not being, that does not become. From the ceasing of this, that ceases. So that's a single knowledge, the knowledge of conditionality. Very simply put, simplest possible way of putting it. This being, that becomes. Easily memorized, easily observed, easy enough to observe things arising, becoming, coming into existence, fading out of existence. Easily observed, easily understood with our intelligence. Easily forgotten, easily ignored, and easily rationalized out of one's awareness. So I guess we probably do all of those easily. So that's, I think, the essence of the first line is probably coming from that. The understanding of all events in the universe, in the world, everything we can observe externally and within ourselves can be understood with this single knowledge. Of conditionality, this being that becomes. One thing that came to mind, that comes to mind when from this, is the account of the Buddha, his own account, of the evening when he attained enlightenment. So, you know, the background to this is that he'd drawn back from the path of asceticism. So we probably don't have to do that. He'd accepted food. He'd drawn back from it. He thought, I've been doing this a long time and it's not getting me, it's not serving my original purpose, which is all to do with understanding the arising of suffering and the faith that there was a way beyond that. So he drew back from that path of asceticism, accepted the offering of food. Sat him down in the shade of a tree, and then he made a resolve, didn't he? He made the resolve, I'm going to stay here until I've done it. And then at one point, this is just on the lead up to the actual moment of enlightenment, at one point what he describes is he surveyed all events. He surveyed all things. It's described in particular way, but basically what you have him doing is surveying all events. So he eats solid food. He says, when I'd eaten solid food and regained some strength, then sat down secluded from unprofitable things, and then entered into a set of whole samatha meditation practices, which brought, of course, experience of great bliss. And then, and each time that happened, he says, but I allowed no such pleasant feeling as arose in me to gain power over my mind. Goes through all the dhyanas. And then says, all the time, yeah, allowing no such pleasure to gain power over my mind. He says, when my concentrated mind was thus purified, bright, unblemished, when it became malleable, wieldy, steady, and attained to imperturbability, I inclined my mind. Well, the way it's described in this, in the Pali Canon, is to the knowledge of the recollection of his past lives. So this life, and then his lives in the past. So he does that for himself. He was in, he has such an appearance, eats such food, has such experience of pleasure, such experience of pain, such and such conditions in his life, and then he does it for all past lives as well. Says goes back aeons. And then he, having surveyed the events in his own life and his past lives, he then does that the same for all beings. Says again, when his mind was purified and bright, directed, inclined his mind to the knowledge of the passing away and arising of creatures. Nice word to use, isn't it? Actually, reminded me of in our group. Oh, Enid's not going to mind me passing this on to everyone, but Enid was telling us in the report in yesterday. She was coming through the field, down through the field yesterday, the one that's got the bullocks in it. And I've done that myself, and the same thing happened to her as happened to me. They've got such kind of ungainly kind of bodies, those kind of particular creatures, and they're very nervous and shy. You know, if you kind of go a bit too abruptly, they back off. But they're also very curious, and they follow you. It is a bit, you said it was a bit like a dog, and it's true, they follow you. So one was following Enid, and she turned around, and she was saying she was just sort of gazing at it, standing looking at his big brown eyes, and this sort of curious kind of, you know, curiosity in the animal, but such kind of nervousness as well. And these big blue eyes kind of looking at her. And of course, what Enid was aware of was that the life of those bullocks is not going to be long. They won't be in that field for very long. They've been there a month or so, and might be a few more months, and then they're going to be taken out, and their life's going to be brought to an end. And, you know, just kind of aware of that. It's very poignant. And what makes it more poignant for me when I'm in that sort of experience is knowing that I have that awareness that something's going to be ending quite soon for that particular creature. But they don't have that awareness. But we have that awareness and are holding it. So maybe it was, you know, on a much, much vaster and more extensive scale. It's a little bit like that with the Buddha casting his eye out over, you know, all beings, all events. So whether you want to think in terms of past lives or not, I don't think it matters. It would be enough, actually, if you could imagine just casting your eye out over all beings who are alive at the moment, never mind whether or not they'd had past lives. But he says that he inclined his mind to the knowledge of passing away and arising of creatures. Saw creatures passing away and reappearing, how they were inferior or superior, fair or ugly, happy or unhappy in their conditions, and I understood how creatures pass on according to their actions, how they arise in happy destinations or unhappy destinations. So that was part of what came to mind with just this reflecting on this understanding of all events as a single knowledge, that the Buddha at that point surveying all these events. And I've thought before that when you come to do any of the last stages of the Brahmaviharas, it's a bit like that. It's maybe not so deliberately looking for the rising and passing away, although it is actually in the Upekkha Bhavana. But if you think of even just doing the last stage of the Metta Bhavana, you could just do it the way you normally do it, but you could maybe put it in the context of that tradition or that inclining of the Buddha's mind to just looking at all creatures from the point of view of arising and passing away. And we're doing something like that when we do the last stage of the Metta Bhavana. Although we're trying to do it, you know, infusing our awareness with a kindly awareness. But put it in that context. Put it in that tradition. Think of it in terms of one way of us trying to understand all events as a single knowledge. So, of course, the understanding of all events as a single knowledge, I was saying it's easily understood with one's intelligence, which in a certain way is true. But it's also hard to see. So you get... I've got the survey here because in the Essence of Enlightenment part of it, Bhante very handily has already picked out loads of quotes about the one knowledge, the conditionality. So I'll just refer to some of them. So a short way of describing what the Buddha has done is he says you find it in chiseled in rock, inscribed on plates of copper, silver and gold, stamped into tablets of baked clay all over the Buddhist world. You get the verse. The Tathagata has explained the origin of those things which proceed from a cause, and their cessation too he has explained, and this is the doctrine of the great Shramana, the great teacher. So that's it put in a nutshell. And then you have also the Buddha's own words saying that at the moment when, you know, he had gained enlightenment but hadn't as yet thought about trying to help other people do the same, what was in his mind, we're told, is this is the Buddha speaking, I have gained the doctrine, the Dharma, reality, which is profound, hard to perceive, hard to know, but is tranquil, transcendent, beyond the sphere of reasoning, subtle, to be known only by the wise. Mankind is intent on its attachments and takes delight and pleasure in them. For mankind intent on its attachments, it is hard to see this principle, namely conditionedness. This principle too is hard to see, namely the cessation of all things, clinging to rebirth, the absence of passion, nirvana. So he knew he was going for a hard thing to do to try and help other beings to incline their mind in the way that he'd had. And then, of course, you get the wee story of Ananda, who said, in appearance and in reality, he knew that conditioned co-production was profound. It was nevertheless quite easy to understand. Kind of similar to what I've just said, actually. And then out of the depth of his realisation, the Buddha says, "Say not so." And deep indeed is this causal law, and deep it appears to be. And it's by not knowing, by not understanding and not penetrating this doctrine, that this world of men has become entangled like a ball of twine, become covered with mildew, become like rushes and munjagrash and rushes, and unable to pass beyond the doom of waste, the ceaseless round of rebirth. And he said the same thing about not being able to understand the Four Noble Truths. It's through not understanding, not penetrating the Four Noble Truths, monks, that we have run on and wandered round this long journey of rebirth, both you and I. So quite short and quite succinct. So you get both the flavour of what it's like to have that understanding of all events as a single knowledge, and also the reflection on the pain and the suffering that arises from not understanding them. It's deep, isn't it? I mean, someone left me a wee note this morning, and it says, "Our emptiness, luminosity, and innate purity as applied to beings, metaphors for the same thing. What about Buddha nature and Tathagatagarbha, same thing again? Or is emptiness different from all the others?" Great, what notes you get, Rachel. So, reply to that. Subhuti talking to the Buddha. Subhuti: "Deep is the essential original nature of dharmas. Deep is the essential nature of perfect wisdom. I pay homage to the perfection of wisdom." And the Buddha agrees and says, "Also, all dharmas are isolated in their essential nature. And their essential nature is identical with the perfection of wisdom. The Tathagata has fully known all dharmas as not made." Subhuti: "Therefore, all dharmas have the character of not having been fully known by the Tathagata?" The Buddha: "It is just through their essential nature that those dharmas are not a something. Their nature is no nature, and their no nature is their nature. Because all dharmas have one mark only, i.e. no mark. It's for this reason that all dharmas have the character of not having been fully known by the Tathagata. For there are not two natures of dharma, but just one single one is the nature of all dharmas. For the nature of all dharmas is no nature, and their no nature is their nature. It is thus that all points of attachment are abandoned." Subhuti: "Deep, O Lord, is the perfection of wisdom." And the Lord replies, "Through a depth like that of space." Very beautiful. Not understood by me, but very beautiful. So we'll leave the first line there then. So the second line of the verse is, "The green colour of her body is power in all faculties. The green colour of her body is power in all faculties." So to me this suggests something, as if it's referring to something embedded that can't or won't be forgotten or ignored. So deeply embedded that can't be forgotten or ignored. You know, it's the very colour of her body, the very colour of Tara's body is expressing the depth of her realisation. And to me also it suggests purpose, it's power in all faculties, purpose and the ability to see that purpose to its end. Faculties could be thought about and reflected on in different ways, and you may find your own connections with them. It could be spiritual faculty, the five spiritual faculties. It could be Tara as the embodiment of the Brahma Viharas. Could be the colour of her body. You could think of her colour of body as the fruits of her practice, couldn't you? Sort of then expresses in the very, you know, a very kind of nature and colour of her form. So the fruits of practice. So we've mentioned some already in terms of the fruits of how your mind, what your mind becomes like as a result of practice. So it's malleable, you know, not fixed, able to adjust to circumstances. Purified, wieldy, steady, imperturbable, and also bright and radiant. So, yeah, you might think of the faculties as what arises from practice, the fruits of practice. So all of those would be ways. You could start an off point. You could start from any of them and just see what your own connections with this particular kind of representation of a compassionate form. So I'm just going to suggest one other way of reflecting on the faculties, and it's taken from the Satipatthana Sutta. So there's a copy of it. In the sutta, there's every now and again there's a verse that's called a definition. It gives a definition of the four Satipatthanas, and then there's another verse which comes in as a sort of refrain or sort of chorus. So we've already touched on what's in the refrain. And I think the word refrain is quite interesting as well, because, you know, last night I was talking about just this idea of the necessity to reflect again and again and again on the nature of our spiritual path. And there's a bit of an element of that in this refrain that comes into the Satipatthana Sutta. It just comes every now and again in the sutta. You get this refrain. After each section you get the refrain. What it is, I'll not read all of it, but the bit that's relevant to this particular part of the talk is: the monk abides contemplating the nature of arising in the body, or he abides contemplating the nature of things passing away in the body, or he abides contemplating the nature of both arising and passing away in the body. And then that's repeated again for when you're focusing on feeling, on Vedana. You abide contemplating the nature of arising, of feeling, of passing away, of feeling, and both arising and passing away. So that very much links into the seeing all events as a single knowledge. But it's instead of being the outward focus, it's the inward focus. It's applying that reflectiveness of conditionality to oneself. So that, the refrain then, I think you could maybe bring that to mind with respect to the first line, seeing all events as single knowledge. The definition is what I'm suggesting we could bring to mind for the green colour of power in all faculties. Because here you get four mental qualities talked about. And again, it's repeated various points. So the four are, the Buddha says, what are the four? That's referring to the four Satipatthanas. He says, if you're practicing the four, the body, a mindfulness of the body, you contemplate the body, and then there's four qualities that you bring to that contemplation. So the four are diligence, clearly knowing, mindfully observing, and being free from desire for the world. So four mental qualities that you bring to your reflections. You bring to your reflections on the mindfulness, on the body, you see. Diligence, clearly knowing, mindfully observing, and free from desire for the world. So diligence is... we can think about it as balanced and sustained effort. That was what was suggested to us earlier in this retreat. Think of diligence as being connected with balanced and sustained effort. So it's not passive. It's not passive. It's not identified with our own personal preferences and idiosyncrasies. It's not sort of within our fence of mind. It's it's more, much more open than that, this diligence. So it's not just that we're prepared to be diligent where we don't mind being diligent, but we're not doing it apart from that. It's not overly identified with our own personal preferences. So not passive, not overly identified with our preference. Also not excessive, not too willful. And not self-asserting. And also not self-suffering. So there's quite a lot maybe to think about in what balanced and sustained diligence would be. So balanced, sustained, dedicated to whatever you wish from your own spiritual path, dedicated to the three jewels, and open to change. So balanced, sustained, dedicated, and open to change. So that's the first quality, diligence. The second one is clearly knowing, and that's got connections of there's a sort of deliberateness in it, and also a kind of sort of indicating kind of heightened intensity of knowing, an almost emotional, heightened emotional intensity of knowing. It's also in the tradition associated with being aware of impermanence, and it seems to imply being able to grasp, to fully grasp, to fully comprehend what is happening, whatever is happening. The clearly knowing quality, if we had it to the fore, would clearly know, clearly, fully grasp, understand what is happening. So if we're just sitting here and we hear a bird noise, a bird singing outside, then we clearly understand just that that's happening. It's just that that's happening, and we know it's just that that's happening. And we hear it and respond to it in all its richness, but we don't add anything into it. We just keep it simple. It's a sort of a mixture maybe of, what comes to mind is a mixture maybe of simple and rich. You know, if we stick to the simplicity of just what's happening in the moment, there's immense richness in it. But all we tend to do is kind of, you know, want complexity or want something more from it and start adding in, you know, what might pass for richness in a certain way. All our kind of ideas go off and, you know, here, there and everywhere. So we add in complexity, but we don't necessarily add in richness. But actually, if we could stick with the simpleness of experience, often there's immense richness and beauty in it. So clearly knowing's got that kind of connotation. Able to understand and fully grasp just what's happening, but not add in extra to that. So it appears often as a kind of, when the Buddha's referring to this sort of clearly knowing faculty, it often comes with an exclamation mark. So when he says to the first monk who got the hang of what enlightenment was about, which I think was Kaundinya, thank you, was Kaundinya, the Buddha said, "He knows, Kaundinya knows!" Exclamation mark. That's got the heightened sense of awareness and emotional response to that. He knows. He's done it. So if we have moments like that, don't we? Oh, I've got it. I understand that now. Or at least you know you understand it better than you've ever understood it before. So he knows. And you get it in the Satipatthana Sutta as well. You get the monk knows, exclamation mark. So it refers to this clearly knowing. And there's a sort of illumined quality to it, which I find very attractive, this illumined nature of knowing. There's a lightness, a radiance to it, seems to imply that. So maybe also that's something to reflect on if you're just turning these verses and these lines in your mind, because the body of Tara is not actually made of bronze and copper and brass. It's actually made of light. So there's an illumined quality to that greenness. It's not a kind of matte, you know, emulsion on the wall. It's illumined light that's the nature of that's our body. So often, and that illumined quality arises from the clearly knowing quality being linked with the next one, which is mindfully observing. So you get mindful and clearly knowing. So it's bringing two mental faculties together, and then they work cooperatively. In the Satipatthana Sutta, they're said to work together cooperatively. So you get sati sampajana. So there's mindful awareness or mindful observation together with or infused by intelligent awareness of the processes involved. And the processes are primarily of arising and falling away, and both, and the interconnection between those. So that illumined quality of knowing comes about particularly when it's working cooperatively with just mindful awareness. And then the fourth quality is free from desires in regard to the world, which brings to mind other aspects of, or seems to suggest other aspects of, a sort of mental composure, the concentrated happy mind isn't looking for satisfaction outside of itself, particularly directed all to the outside world. It suggests a calmness and a contentment. And it also suggests an awareness of the futility of that kind of outwardly directed searching for lasting happiness. And there's bits in all sorts of texts, but there's a particular line in the Bodhicharavatara, where Shantideva says, just reflecting on beings and, you know, reflecting on how seeking happiness, wishing for happiness, they seek it out in the world. Wishing for happiness, they seek it elsewhere, not within themselves. What a pity. So it's that sort of freedom from desire, I think, has also got the suggestion that you are really aware of the unsatisfactoriness of when you seek for desire out, apart from just inwardly. So those four mental faculties then perhaps help with that particular line. The green colour of a body is power in all faculties. Okay, enough.